You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Primarily, what we're hoping to learn in this initial phase of the research is just what the sensitivity, if at all, of a striped bass is to magnetic fields and what physiological mechanism and what physical organ is responsible for that sensitivity.
I want to welcome everyone today. We have a really, really cool follow-up from the science symposium that we had up in Cape Cod at Woods Hole. We were the guests of Scott Bennett and the Marine Biologic Lab, and had an awesome discussion on some crazy cool work that they are doing on striped bass and other, you know, kind of fish up there. So I want to introduce Scott and Brian to the audience, and we're going to hop right into it. How are y'all doing today, guys?
Doing good, Tony. Thanks for having us.
I'm all right. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Brian. So Scott's in Woods Hole. I believe Brian is in Chicago. And somehow everything's working on the podcast software. So without further ado, we're going to get into a couple of things. I think the first thing that we want to get into is Scott's office is right there on the famous eel pond at Woods Hole. And they have started doing telemetry work, probably started 5 or 6 years ago, because they kept seeing the same striped bass return year after year. And being a scientist, Scott and his team said, hey, we should study that. So guys, let's tell the audience a little bit about, you know, the first telemetry work that y'all did with the eel pond stripers and what you learned.
Yeah. Thanks, Tony. So I think to kind of preface everything that we're going to talk about today, I should mention our colleague, Steve Zottoli, who started this program years and years ago without any kind of money. And it was basically just him coming out and observing these fish that have been coming to Eel Pond for, you know, decades, basically as long as our Marine Resources Department here has been collecting squid for biomedical research. The striped bass have been coming and hanging out to eat the stuff that gets kind of tossed out the back. So I just want to give credit where credit's due to the genesis of this program to him, because he started it with nothing, observations, brought some students in, collected a little bit of funding, and it kind of snowballed up until 5 years ago when the Edwin Barbee Charitable Trust really funded us in a capacity that allowed us to kind of pursue some of this really interesting, cool, and novel research that we've been doing. So to just give a brief description of what the situation is here in Woods Hole. So Eel Pond is a fully tidal, small little harbor with moorings. The MBL facility abuts it. We're right on the pond there, and we have our dock with our collection vessels. And we have these populations of migratory striped bass that show up in the spring and hang out there and just sit and wait for food and then leave in the fall. And while they're here, they remain residents of this pond throughout the entire summer. Every once in a while, you'll have individuals come and go, but for the most part, they stick to the pond. And then more specifically, these areas right off the dock where they kind of sit during the day and wait to be fed. So, this really,
and they're coming from all over.
And they're coming from all over. So one of the really cool things is that we have this population of fish that hang out together for 3-4 months. And then when they leave, they all split and they all go different places. It's the spread of all the big areas. It's Chesapeake, it's Delaware. We've tracked some of our fish all the way up to Albany. Some of them have gone up to the Kennebec. So they kind of spread out all over the place, even though they all come together here. And so what's interesting about this population is that we have individuals that come back year to year. And so that was one of the really interesting things that we were kind of utilizing to try to start to understand a little bit about the animals' daily and seasonal behavior patterns, their migratory patterns, and how their spawning destinations dictate their arrivals and departures from their summer feeding areas, things like that. So that's kind of the broad, strokes of our population there.
Okay, so I was there for the science symposium, and I guess right when the science symposium was done or we broke for lunch, I don't remember, we went down to your pier and basically hand fed, 20 something to 30 something in striper squid, which was just so cool. I got a video of it. It was just so awesome. And the cool thing was is that you could see the Floyd tags, the physical spaghetti tags that were on external on the fish. And a lot of those fish have those telemetry tags. So I think our audience knows about, telemetry tags and how they have a unique beep and they go past a receiver, and then it's that fish and you can get all sorts of cool data from it. But I guess the next level of this is that y'all take, when you're doing this, you're land-based and you have the ability to kind of anesthetize the fish, take pictures of both sides of them. Then you have interns from like area high schools go around Eel Pond with video cameras and capture images of the fish swimming around. And you try to kind of match those up the same way they do with great whites. You're learning a lot. But then enters the Got One app, artificial intelligence, and then it's kind of like next level stuff. So you want to give us a download on that, Scott?
Yeah. So the stripe aberration work was started by actually the original work was done by a few high school and grade school interns. They just did some baseline studies where they would draw. Based on these underwater video, they would draw kind of stripe aberrations, and then they would have somebody else draw the same stripe aberration on the same fish and see if they could match them up. And it kind of snowballed from there. And so we were able to start doing underwater imaging of some of these fish that would come back year after year. And so when we tag these animals, so when we pull them out of the water and tag them, you're right on. So we anesthetize them and then implant the acoustic telemetry transmitter, which is the same ones that most people who are doing fish tracking studies use. And when we do that, we also take high resolution, clear images of the left and right hand side of the fish in order to document them at the point of capture. And then when they come back year after year, we use underwater GoPros to take images of them swimming around. And so what we've been doing is observing that at a certain point in the development of the fish. So we can't say for sure at what point these stripes become static and fixed, or if they are fixed later in life. But in the years that these animals visit us and we have records of, the stripe patterns on the sides don't change. And so you can theoretically use these patterns, these unique patterns, to identify individuals. This is one of the really interesting things that we were looking at. So then
y'all have like hundreds of pictures.
Yeah. So over the
these sides that are specifically taken for people to match individuals. And then we connected with Lou from Got One. Y'all started nerding out, salivating over this. You gave Lou, you know, very kind of you, you gave Lou all of these images, and then the AI starts learning.
Yeah.
And we're like, from my discussions with Lou, it's like 80% of the way there. And we know, that it doesn't know that, you know, y'all took these pictures and it's the right fish. It's learning on its own, and it's making, because we are 100% sure, you know, through the Floyd tag, through the transmitter, we know it is fish, you know, A2470, and then the AI is starting to see it and learn, which is crazy.
Yeah.
And we have verification, right? So,
right.
Yeah. I mean, that's wild. I'm waiting for the drone swarm and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But that's okay. I got plans.
The connection with Lou was really great, and it was quick, because I heard him talking on this podcast a long time ago. And then I heard him, I was driving my kid to school and, you know, swerved off the road when he started talking about using AI to identify fish, because it was one of the things that we had been working on. So I reached out to him. He wrote back to me in about 10 minutes and was gung ho. We got together on a call with him and his team and started talking about this stuff, and his AI team. I was describing that, you know, what we were looking for and what we had seen on the fish. And they were like, oh, they're like, you know, scales are just pixels. He's like, this is easy. We can just, you know, do this. So it might not be as easy for other species, but for striped bass as the kind of initial, test subject, it's a good starting point. So we're really, really excited about that.
You know, what are the next steps? What have y'all found out from those telemetry studies, you know, being able to track these fish around the ocean? Was there anything surprising? Do they come back, you know, on temperature? Is it a moon cycle, you know, where they come back to the eel pond? Because these are fish from the Hudson, from the Chesapeake Bay, from Delaware Bay. These fish are coming from everywhere, and they're coming back to this, what? I mean, what is it, 100 acres, 75 acres, the eel pond? It ain't that big.
Maybe even less than that. I'll let Brian kind of talk about this, because this is his bailiwick from the work that he's been doing. So we've seen these animals coming from all different places. They are visiting different freshwater systems at different times of the year. Even sometimes they visit one, they'll visit another. We're seeing a lot of, on their migration pattern, we're seeing a lot of really interesting choices that these animals are making. And then the other really cool thing is their behavior while they are seasonally resident here in Eel Pond. And that's where Brian's research has really kind of shined and given us some really interesting results.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. If that's a chance to talk about our chronobiology research, you know, I've been interested for forever in how behavior changes over time. And there are a lot of different timescales over which behavior changes. I mean, if you think about us over the course of a day, right, there are times a day when you're alert and times a day when you're tired, times a day when you're eating and times a day when you're not eating, which is kind of interesting, right? You have these intra-daily bouts of behavior. And then, of course, you have behavior that's structured over the course of the day, right? Sleep-wake cycle, social interactions, activity, rest, things like that. And then, of course, there's activity that's scheduled over the course of the year. And so we thought the striped bass were a really, really interesting and rich population in which to look at one organism and how their behavior is structured, you know, over the course of all these different timescales. And when Steve and Scott and I first started implanting fish with telemetry devices. Scott, if you remember this, the first round of telemetry devices only recorded temperature, right? And we implanted five fish in the fall of 2018. And in the spring of 2019, four of those five fish came back, and it was just an absolute home run. And so we're there recording their activity. And I had, knowing very little about their behavior and being completely arrogant, I think, I was like, all right, this is going to be great. We're going to get these fish to come back to Yale Pond. I bet they're here for one part of the day, and then they go swim somewhere else during a different part of the day. So we'll pick them up at the receiver stations in bouts of activity. And, you know, a lot of my work in the laboratory studies mammals. And so one of the sort of general indicators of activity we look at in mammals is the iconic stereotypical hamster running in its running wheel, right? I mean, it runs during the nighttime and not during the day. And I thought we'd have a record of when the fish were in Yale Pond. Steve Zottoli had been seeing them in the morning and in the evening, but you know, they're gone by nighttime. And so we figured they left. Maybe they went out to the harbor and so forth. So this first round of fish that appeared, when we pulled their data off, we saw something that was nothing short of spectacular. It was recording their core body temperature, and we saw that their body temperature was elevated during the daytime and it was low at night. And it was elevated during the daytime and it was low at night. And there was this gorgeous daily rhythm in body temperature. And Steve and I stared at it for about 5 minutes and said, oh, man, this is absolutely meaningless. These guys are not endotherms. These guys are floating thermometers. And what we're getting is water temperature, not body temperature. And so we, on one hand, we were like, oh, it's a little disappointing. But on the other hand, we realized, wait a minute, but we're getting measures every 2 to 3 minutes, 24/7. And what it told us actually was these fish are not leaving the pond. They show up and they stick around. And so, you know, they're handy floating thermometers. They're always there. But the key is that they're always there. And so that allowed us to ask more questions. First of all, you know, why do they show up and not leave? And by not leave, most of these fish, when they arrive in the spring, we get a ping on the receiver from a fish every 2 to 3 minutes for the next 6 months. And they never leave. Occasionally, they'll be gone for, you know, a 15-minute bout. But the thing is, we're not picking them up. We have receivers on the exit, the egress point by the channel, and out in the Great Harbor. So if they were leaving, we pick them up at one of those, we think. I mean, not guaranteed. But our best guess is that these fish show up, and for almost the entire summer, they stay there. And so in subsequent years, we implanted them with transmitters that, in addition to recording temperature, water temperature pretty much, we're recording depth as well. And that's allowed us to look at really, really spectacular circadian rhythms in the use of the water column. So during the daytime, they're up at the surface, and at night, they're foraging out and exploring in deeper waters.
Yeah, and that was the, so Brian's data was a lot of the data that I presented at the symposium. So it was kind of really interesting to see these very stark and distinct circadian patterns once we really kind of got the idea of what these animals were doing and were able to really kind of dial in on a fine scale and look at them.
And just then, so the audience doesn't have to use the Google, right, to look up circadian rhythm, it's just a 24-hour cycle of life. And just to piggyback on what you said, Brian, I am usually sleepy and eating. You know, you had laid out a couple of different things like alert, you know, whatever. My circadian rhythm is about 23 hours of tired and eating. I don't know if that, you know, you said you specialize in mammals. I don't know if that puts me in a hamster category, but I would probably look at the wheel and laugh. Be like, you idiots run on that thing. I'm going to eat some more and then take a nap. So yeah, so I don't know if I would be shunned in the hamster world, probably.
Yeah, the hamsters would run laps around you, I think.
I'm okay with that. I'm totally okay with it. Yeah, circles. Haha. Yep. But all we got left at this age is dad jokes, Brian. Right. So okay. So we have you guys have kind of seen a 24-hour cycle for these fish in the eel pond. They're kind of coming from everywhere. We've covered a little bit of the artificial intelligence, you know, and I think the end goal for that would be, you know, to take those videos that the interns are getting from the little GoPros and be able to give the AI that video. And it's just like, ding, 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 match, not a match, new fish, you know, whatever. The interesting thing I will say about the AI is it's not necessarily the stripe pattern. When we started this, you know, Lou's part of that global fish AI consortium. A friend who heads up U.S. Geological Services in West Virginia, you know, kind of for the East Coast. He has an AI team. They totally nerd it out with Lou. And believe it or not, like when you look at a trout, so other countries have been able to track a trout from like par to like 16, 18 inch fish. And it's not because of the spot pattern, which you would think on a rainbow or a brown or whatever. It's actually because the par marks never fade. That's so it's matching the stripers, but we don't know how. We can't back engineer it. And these are just like private conversations with Lou. I think we've said them on podcasts before. But I don't know, you know, who knows? It could be like that individual fish had a damaged scale. That individual fish had like, you know, a small scar on its back. We don't know how it's doing it. And if you look at the AI model, like when the AI actually does it, it looks like a county map of like Wisconsin that it's overlaying on the fish. And then it just goes to work. And you don't know what the hell it's doing. And it's just, it's looking for things that we cannot see. That's the best way that I can describe it. And I think there's so much potential for us to learn, you know, because we have multiple, right now we're tagging false albacore, Jack Crevalle, Spanish mackerel. And my first question to any of the folks at NOAA is like, do you really need this? Because if you need it, we will do it. But if you don't need it, we're not going to stick a tag in a fish for it to swim around with that thing sticking out of it and accumulate growth on it, you know, impede its life. We don't want to do that. We're not just doing it to be like, hey, look, I'm helping. I just that little Simpsons kid who picked his nose. Like, we don't want to be that recreational angler group. And I think the end game, and it may be a year from now, it may be 5 years from now, but the end game is to have this massive repository of images of fish in that app, in the Got One app. And then every time somebody puts a new fish in, the AI automatically scans it and looks for a match for anything that's been previously recorded. Now, those are lofty goals, but the end game would mean, you know, in 5 years, maybe we start phasing out Floy tags and we can use AI to scan images, fish images, and we just get a ton of information on migrational patterns, growth rates, because the AI also has LIDAR, so it can judge the fish's size probably more accurately than laying the thing down on a ruler. And look, you know, you have to be the first, right? You have to try stuff. This is pretty cutting edge, and thank God for Lou and people like y'all who have all these pictures. But I'm very hopeful for AI in this regard. It's like I mentioned before, like the drone swarm and all that, you know, coming to make us their batteries scares the shit out of me. But right now, it's funny. Like I was telling Lou, he forces me to use ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. For some things, just so I get familiar with it. And I'm always very nice and polite. I'm like, oh, thank you. That was nice of you to do that. Like you did a very, you know, it's kind of like the Southern is coming out in me. And I'm like, why? Thank you very much. And he's like, why are you doing that? And I'm like, well, when my overlords come knocking,
exactly,
you know, they'll make me part of their interstellar carnival with hopefully breeding rights or something, you know, while the rest of y'all are plugged in, you know, as little solar cells. I'll be, you know, traveling the universe on a trapeze or something. So, you know, haha, I'm like two steps ahead of you. You think you're so smart, you're scientists. Yeah. So anyway, and I know the AI is listening right now, so I got you, buddy. I'm with you. I'll teach you anything you want about my people. So I'm just padding the stats. You know, I got kids, man. I gotta, you know, gotta think of their future too. So we have the telemetry work, we have the AI. And now here we go. For eons, I am a waterfowler. Okay. And I used this analogy. Garden and Gun came out with an article and I almost fell out of my chair and I wasn't drinking. And there was a hen pintail. So like, much like our fish, the technology for tags is, you know, is exponentially better than it was 5 years ago. So they can put these little tracking, these tiny, tiny little tracking tags on ducks now, and we can track ducks, satellite. So this hen pintail was tagged. I know it was in the Mississippi Flyway. Let's say it was somewhere between Missouri. And if my friend Greg Hartley from Missouri is listening, I want a couple of bonus points for pronouncing the name of your state correctly. It's Oregon, not Oregon, and it's Missouri, not Missouri. It's a good way to end up in a cornfield if you say Missouri and you're in Missouri. So this pintail disappeared, and they thought it was going to go up to Saskatchewan and, you know, nest where all the other hen pintails are nesting. And then all of a sudden, it just reappeared again a couple of months later. And it downloaded all the data, and the thing went to Russia. It went to Russia. It flew across the Bering Strait, actually the Bering Sea. That's not something a hen pintail was kind of known for. And I hate even bringing this up because I love hunting ducks. And now we got to get into like international duck management with Russia. That doesn't really like give me warm and fuzzies to think about that. But yes. So like we were now able to be like, oh my gosh, how did this happen? This thing had intention. It didn't get lost. What is really going on? And then, you know, as a duck hunter, as just a lover of nature and a watcher of nature, you know, how do these things find their way back? How does a striper from Delaware or the Chesapeake Bay or the Hudson find this teeny tiny little blip of water off the Atlantic and say, I'm going back there, and I'm going back there year after year because Scott has the best squid and he hands feeds me and I'm going to go back there. And I told y'all, like, animals amaze me. This morning I took my son fishing and I watched a mom and dad bald eagle just staring at the sky and staring at the four or five ospreys that were out hunting this morning. And I've seen it from these parents specifically. They teach the juveniles. He didn't have a white head yet. They teach the juveniles how to steal from ospreys. That is pretty effing advanced. We don't give animals the credit that they deserve. So y'all have looked at this question. How do these things that we think are so dumb, how do they navigate better than us? What are they connected to? If I told my son to go down to the end of the street without his Google map, he may or may not end up in, like, I don't know, coastal Virginia, right? I mean, you just, like, how the hell do these things come back to this? And we know this from Floy tagging too. I have watched someone Floy tag a striper off a rock pile, and they caught the same damn striper a year later, almost to the day, off the same damn rock pile. And these things do not, trust me, they do not stay here. Okay. They get that they are moving around, right? I mean, it's pretty well documented. How did it go back to the X marks the spot? So I've set this up and I want y'all to teach us. Well, explain to us what y'all are trying to learn and how you're trying to learn it, because I think this is like an age old question across species.
Well, I'm going to let you and all your listeners down, Tony. We have no idea.
Not a clue. I'm more into the when, not the how.
Yeah. So it is an interesting question, because we know that depending on what type of fish you are, the way that you go to your spawning and breeding grounds is different. And it can be a combination of cueing in on light intensity from seasonal changes. It can be chemical cues that that orient fish to their spawning grounds. A lot of animals on Earth use the magnetic tilt and fields from the Earth to direct their migrations, or some kind of combination of all three. It's one of the big things with striped bass. That's kind of the big question, is like just what you said, Tony. How do they know where they're going, right? And so when they leave, say, the Chesapeake, is it a series of I just need to get from this point to this point, and then when I'm at, it's like Cape Cod is point F and the Chesapeake is point A. Do they need to get to point B before they can know C? Before, is it a series kind of linked chains that if they don't have one, they can't get to the other? Or is it a straight shot? And so that's one of the things that's kind of unknown. But one of the studies that we were kind of starting to venture on this year in a little bit more trying to kind of attack with a little bit more veracity is looking at the potential for magnetoreception in these fish and whether or not they have it. And if they do, when these animals develop the organs responsible for being able to perform that behavior. So we have a field and we have a lab study kind of set up now. One is looking at adult feeding. So the fish that gather here, we have a study that we're going to kind of reconduct where we test the effects of different size, really strong batteries on their feeding. So we know that they are cued into food. If you throw a squid in the water, as you observed, it's not there for very long. And so one of the things we want to look at is whether or not there's any detrimental effect of different strength magnets to feeding, as a way to kind of infer how they react to magnets. And then one of the laboratory portions of the research that we're going to do is looking at juvenile animals and taking sections of the head and brain and trying to diagnose whether or not any of these systems have elevated accumulations of things like iron that would theoretically indicate that it is a magnetosensitive organ. And so we know that things like eels have really strong accumulations of iron in their head that allow them to kind of navigate from where they go, where they spawn. So it's kind of the first steps of what we're looking at. So hopefully we'll see different developmental stages of these fish and look at the animals and see when theoretically this accumulation of this theoretical accumulation, I want to be careful what we're saying here, of iron occurs, and if that corresponds to year four of like males when they start to migrate and do their thing, and just kind of get an idea of what could be responsible for their capacity to migrate.
the next thing, I'll tell you what, man, eels are a huge part, you know, the Chesapeake Bay ecosystem. Of course, they're in terrible shape, you know, because yellow eels and then elvers, the glass eels, you know, the juveniles are, you know, highly sought after, and God, what a mess. But yeah, did y'all know that they're like the critical animal in the life cycle of freshwater mussels or clams? You know that? I know more than a couple. When they eat the life cycle of, I guess, the freshwater mussel is they ingest, it has to live in an eel's stomach for X amount of time. During whatever, you know, where it looks like a little crazy brine shrimp crab instead of a clam. And then they poop it out, or mussel rather, and then they poop it out and it's a mussel. And there was just a thing. Oh God, I don't care. I'm going to take a pretty hard stand here. I despise bow fishing. Hate it. For a myriad of reasons. And they just put a limit on, like, it's like 10 buffalo, which is a kind of a carp, not a buffalo, folks. It's a freshwater fish in like Oklahoma, because they perform the same function for freshwater mussels as the eels do. And these bow fishermen were just killing garbage cans full of them, and the ecosystems were starting to collapse. They're like, ah, they're rough fish. They're trash. There's so many of them. Let us shoot them all and throw them at the ramp to rot in the sun. Cause you know, we like shooting stuff. They had to put emergency regulations in. I believe it was in Oklahoma, but you mentioned eel, you mentioned the iron in their head. And that is one of the demise factors for the freshwater filtration systems that we know as mussels. Yeah. So, what do you hope to learn?
What we're hoping to learn in this initial phase of the research is just what the sensitivity, if at all, of a striped bass is to magnetic fields, and what physiological mechanism and what physical organ is responsible for that sensitivity. So before we ask broader questions about how they use it or how sensitive it is, we have to kind of understand that kind of fundamental base. And that's kind of what we're trying to pursue right now. So, and it's not like this is something far-fetched, because like we said before, you know, lots of animals utilize magnetic fields, you know, birds do it. We know some fish do it. So we're just trying to figure out if striped bass are one of these animals, if it's only magnetoreception that they're using, or if it's some combination of light, like photoperiod, chemical cues, vast different things. Because once you start getting into areas where animals are using multiple inputs to perform their migrations, then you get into some really complex situations and how things like migration and how spawning and survival is affected by changes in temperature and pollution, if you know, mixing with chemical cues and all different types of things. So
okay, seems like one of those things where when you figure something out, you have 10 more questions.
Exactly. Yeah,
but at least somebody's trying to figure it out. Not that you know, other people haven't tried that in the past. I know these science types are very, you know, sensitive towards these bold statements that I'm known to make. So we have covered 24-hour movements of striped bass. We have covered the telemetry studies and how these things come back to like a 10 by 10 spot every year, year after year, and they come from all over the place. We have covered how y'all are trying to drill down and answer some questions on basically how fish navigate. Last thing from the land of the weird, you have a resident population of striped bass that live in a small little tributary on Martha's Vineyard, which is an island.
Yep.
And they live there year round and they don't migrate.
Yep. That's right.
That was one of the presentations, I think. And look, no, the stripers are not going to Canada. Go look at our history. Listen to the scientists from Canada. They don't go around the corner when they go to Maine. None of them do. Stop it. Striped bass are in the shitter. Accept it. Embrace it. We're trying to fix it. But they can behave really weird and not normal, you know, not what we would consider the normal migrational patterns for striped bass. And from what we learned at the Science Symposium, there's this bizarre, tiny subpopulation of stripers that are on indigenous people's lands in Martha's Vineyard that live there year round. Tell us about this goofy ass little population of stripers that makes no sense.
Yeah. So let me start by saying, because of all the, you know, all the podcasts that you could be talking about this on, this is probably one where you start talking about overwintering fish and everyone listening goes, okay. Tell me something. Yeah. Does the sun also rise and all that kind of stuff? So this is by no means unique to this population. You know, people on the Cape have their spots, and this is not the only one. You know, anyone in New England on the coast has some spot where they can go in December and catch a striped bass. But the nice thing about this population of fish is that, like ours here in Eel Pond, they're easily accessible and relatively easy to study. Probably a year and a half ago, I made a connection with the Natural Resources Department of the Wampanoag Tribe of Aquinna at Gayhead on the island, and started talking to them about our research, and expressed interest in trying to locate overwintering populations so that we could theoretically compare their behaviors to our migratory population that we have that visits during the summer, and see if things around that circadian rhythm behavior matched up, or if it was significantly different, or basically, you know, how these animals that choose to overwinter, how their behavior differs from animals that choose to migrate. And that's one of the kind of the big overarching things that we've started noticing with a lot of the research that we're doing, is that these fish are not as hardwired biologically as they seem to be. They are still able to make decisions, because they're fish that go someplace one year, they go someplace the next year, they do certain things one time, and they choose to do something else the next time. One of the things that we found with this population of overwintering fish on the vineyard was that we tagged 20 fish in the fall of 2023. We tagged 20 fish that we got from the same population out of Squibnocket Pond. 19 of those fish stayed in the pond all throughout the winter. We have telemetry receivers in the pond that we checked throughout the winter, and that population of 19 fish stayed there. That 20th fish, the last data upload we got, saw it off of Block Island in November. And so hopefully when we get another data push, we'll see kind of where it's gone otherwise. But it was interesting because, again, you have this population of fish that's all together in one relatively small area that's open to the ocean. So these fish are free to come and go as they please, but 19 of them stayed for whatever reason. That 20th fish decided to go. This next year, we are going to be continuing to observe this population, tagging some new fish in order to kind of build a more robust idea of what these animals are doing. What we're really excited to see is how many of those 19 fish will come back to the pond in the fall. Because this spring, I got a text from one of my colleagues out there with this underwater video that they had set up to track river herring coming in and out. And it was mid-April. I forget what exactly day it was, but he sent me this little video clip, and he said, I just watched 75 striped bass leave the pond, zip past this video camera on their way out into Vineyard Sound. And the next day he said, I think we counted roughly like 120 fish just left. So they left en masse, and it was super cool. So we are really interested to see how many of those fish that we tagged come back. And then once we see that, we can start asking some, depending on what we see, we can start asking some really interesting questions about why a fish might want to stay 1 year and leave the next. And are there differences, are changes in where that fish ultimately goes for spawning, right? So like I said before, we've had animals that we've tracked over 4 years that have come back to Woods Hole each summer, but we see them go to different freshwater rivers and bays, different years. So it's one of the kind of really interesting mysteries that we're trying to drill down on a little bit.
Well, y'all are sure doing a hell of a lot of research, and it's much appreciated. And you know, one of the interesting things, Scott, is like, you know, there are species that we work on that are data poor. Like, we don't even know where they spawn. We don't know sex and age. We don't know shit. And it's kind of like every little tidbit that we get or can figure out is a huge step forward into managing these fish better. That said, you'd be pretty hard pressed to find a fish that has more research on it than a striped bass. I mean, we have poured untold amounts of resources, dollars, time, and it's almost like we are always finding new stuff. Even with a species that's been researched to the level that striped bass have been researched. I mean, I there's some papers coming out now from Maryland that are very concerning, that I'm not allowed to talk about, or the scientists will probably never talk to me again. but I am putting the screws to them to get this stuff out so we can manage the fish better. And then, like, you know, we kind of listen to, everything that you had to say. And, you know, look, I mean, for the layman, for the layperson, this is, you would think, like, they would just think that these are pretty basic questions that we don't know the answer to, in spite of all the research that we have. You know, why are these fish coming back to this tiny little area? Any surf fisherman or boat fishermen will tell you that, you know, this time of year, a couple minutes before sunrise, middle of the night, up until the sun gets high enough, high tide, there's going to be stripers cruising a shoreline. Where exactly do they go once that sun's up? You know, y'all are, that's the circadian rhythm. You know, a fisherman understands that, can dial that in for their local area, they're going to catch more fish, right? And that's, I think, knowing the stuff for science is one thing, and actually catching more fish with your knowledge, I think that's really the effing goal, right? I mean, that's what fishermen really, really want. So that's super cool stuff. So we have, how do they come back to this little 10 by 10 area when they're swimming, you know, a couple of hundred miles from all over different estuaries? How to what, you know, their movements on a 24-hour cycle, and then, like, how do they navigate, and then why is there a subpopulation that just kind of lives in this creek?
Yeah.
And like, what's, yeah, the other thing that y'all talked about was their impact on the forage species, right?
Yeah, so that was one of the things that really drove the collaborative research that we're doing right now, and the multi-year project that we're working on in the vineyard, because the river herring that come back to that the little stream that feeds into Squibnocket. The river herring that come back there to spawn, the populations, river herring in general, are not doing great, kind of up and down the coast. But in particular, this population has been declining and diminishing. And so they've been, the Natural Resources Department, the Tribal Natural Resources Department, has been working on trying to rehabilitate the river herring population there, because it was a traditional fishery, and something that tribal members on the island still utilize to this day. And so they're trying to rebuild this. And so one of the collaborative points that we're working on is how a predator of river herring, striped bass, how their behaviors, movements, and timing of those connect to the arrivals of spawning river herring and what impact they're having on a declining population. So that was one of the things that we were particularly interested in examining.
Well, y'all are not sitting around resting on your laurels. And you know, I think a partnership between a nonprofit and association like ours and active researchers who are, you know, really trying to answer some fundamental questions is super important. That we use the assets that we have to get the information out so people know that this stuff is going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I did this on the podcast that we had to trash because my audio was screwed up, and we want to give our listeners the best quality audio quality that we can. And apparently it sounded like I was playing drums on my microphone, according to my podcast editor, who I got a tongue lashing from. But it's really important that we have people like y'all on here. So I think based on the current situation with stripers, I think it gives people a lot of hope to know that there are people out there that are trying to answer these fundamental questions. And hopefully all of this science is incorporated into management, where, you know, the more pieces of the puzzle that we can put in, the less, hopefully the easier management decisions become, because they're not easy right now. No. And that's, you know, that's ultimately the goal. And that's why we value these partnerships. ASGA is super looking forward to the Science Symposium 2025, which we're already eagerly planning for. And Scott, you know, the stuff that we do, you know, the science that we try to fund, the science that you're trying to fund, you know, those dollars, for a variety of reasons, are becoming harder and harder to acquire. And you know, they're certainly not wasted. So if there's anyone out here listening, you know, that wants to help support Scott's work directly, do you want to give them like the Instagram where they can follow and send y'all a message if they want to donate, anything like that? You know, what's the best way for a listener who wants to make a difference? Or maybe, who knows, maybe there's somebody here listening that's pretty close to Woods Hole and wants to be involved and help y'all out, you know, taking pictures or learn more, or, you know, my daughter's Girl Scout group, my son's Boy Scout group, whatever, you know, they want to help out. I don't know, man, you know, the more the merrier kind of thing, but money really, really helps. So how would they, what's the best way to learn more and get in touch with you, Scott?
Yeah. So if you want to, we have a semi-regularly updated Instagram account, because my social media manager, who is me, does what I can. So if you follow that, it's just Striped Bass Magic on Instagram. But if you want to get in contact with me and have any questions about the program, or just want to, you know, talk, kind of find out what's going on, maybe find out how you can get involved or help, you can just reach out to me my email is sbennett@mbl.edu. We can probably put that in the show description or something like that. Yeah, I'd be happy to talk to anyone. It's fun stuff. You know, there could be worse things to be doing on a day-to-day basis. So,
but I can attest to that.
Yeah. But I want to, so, you know, I want to really thank you, Tony, and ASGA for all of the help, you know, since we got introduced to each other, you know, not even that long ago. You've been a real, real advocate, and appreciate it. All the help that you've been giving, you know, the bizarre text messages back and forth on a variety of different subjects is always entertaining. But
it is paramount that some of these questions are answered, that there's the right people asking the right questions, that there's more collaboration and partnership between fishermen and scientists. And, you know, this is just the beginning. We look forward to many, many more conversations to come and updates on the research that you're doing. And, you know, thanks to you and Brian for being on the podcast, and look forward to having you on again here real soon.
Thanks, Tony. I appreciate the invite, and we're in good company here.